Hey, Internet. He's John. I'm Mark. Last week, we talked about books we would like to see turned into movies. I prepared for that, but failed, I realized as we went to tape, to come up with the opposite, a book I treasured that I didn't want adapted for screen. This is The Enthusiast Cast, the web show where we gab about stuff we like and then tell you about one awesome book. This week, I'm enthusiastic about The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis. But before we get to that, John, you threw the no adaptation question at me last week, just kind of as an afterthought. You tagged it on to the end of the conversation. What criteria did you use to narrow your list, and what one book are you locking away in kind of your emotional safe room, hoping to keep it safe from Hollywood?
Well, in trying to come up with a book that fit that criteria, my main thing was that there was something inherent in the book which I felt was inherent in the language, which obviously is the one thing that you couldn't replicate in a film. You can replicate tone, you can replicate feeling, you can replicate symbolism, you can replicate plot and spectacle, but if so, there's something sort of embedded in the effect of words, in it, in the bookness of the book, then obviously you're going to fail in that. And then I also looked at books that I thought there were things in it that filmmakers would get caught up with, and they would make it all about, you know, this imagery or this character or what have you, and they would miss kind of the thing about the book that I thought was so great. So they'd think that they were making a great movie, but in fact they'd be missing the point completely. So the book that I came up with, the book that I really don't want to, that I love, but I don't want to see turned into a film, is Winter's Tale by Mark Halperin. And that's a book that was first published in 1983. I read it in 1994. And it's difficult to describe the plot. You know, if I had to try, I'd say it's a love story. It's set in a mythical alternate universe New York near the turn of the 20th century. It features a thief named Peter Lake who falls in love with a dying girl named Beverly Penn. There's a man who's trying to build a bridge out of rainbows that's going to signal the end of the world. And there's a flying horse named Athansor. And it makes it sound like the crappiest fantasy, B-grade fantasy novel in the world, but it actually is a highly literary novel. And it's a book that I loved when I first read it. And when doing research for this question, I discovered that the screenwriter Akiva Goldsman was considering making a film adaptation of this book, his directorial debut. He's written the worst of the Batman films, the one with George Clooney and Batman and Robin, with him and Arnold Schwarzenegger. But he also wrote A Beautiful Mind. Like, he's, you know, a well-known, well-respected screenwriter in Hollywood, and I guess he wants to segue into directing. And this was a book that he very rightfully said, you know, is a book that he loves, and so he was considering this. Since that talk, he has apparently moved on to a different project. Maybe this is on the back burner. I'm hoping that he won't, not because I have any animus towards Akiva Goldsman. I just don't think that anybody should make this into a film, because I think that ultimately it would be reductive. I think whatever you did in a film, if it was based on this, it would be a reduction of what is in the book. I feel like this is a great book to inspire a film, but not to be source material. I should say one other note, though. When I was thinking about this book, I was also thinking about your experience with Jose Saramago's Blindness, where you were, that was a book that you loved when you were in your early 20s, and then you just came back to it recently and it didn't have the impact that it had then. And so this is a book that I loved when I was in my early 20s. Not only that, but it was like a gift from a girl that I was dating at the time. And, you know, only recently science has been able to prove that if you get a book as a gift from a girl that you like and there's an inscription in the book, you're about 87% more likely to think that that book is super awesome. So on the one hand, there's a part of me that wants to go back and read this book, you know, with hopefully, you know, more wisdom under my belt and see if there's perhaps more, because it feels like the kind of book that there is probably more, even more in it than the 21-year-old me was able to get out of it. But then there's another part that feels like, maybe I'm just going to, you know, maybe it's not what I thought it was when I was 21, or it wouldn't be to the me now what I thought it was when I was 21, and I'd just be screwing up a nice memory. So I'll let you know if I decide to reread it.
Okay, so two questions. Okay. Is Halperin a science fiction guy? Like, I don't know him at all.
No. He's a literary guy.
This was like his one detour into sci-fi, and he just really nailed it in your mind?
Yeah, I haven't read any of his other stuff. He's got a book that called A Soldier of the Great War, which is obviously about the First World War that I've been meaning to read. But and this isn't even sci-fi or fantasy. I almost want to say it's more magical realism, except in parts it's kind of full-on magic and myth, so it's not really magical realism that's sort of classically defined.
And then my second question, I wanted to ask you about the girl, but you don't have to answer.
No, this isn't the too much information cast. I'm going to say.
So your comment about you know, a good inspirational material for movies, you know, makes me think of Neuromancer and the William Gibson early stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Which is just like, thank goodness, you know, a part of me is like, thank goodness that they never bought the rights and adapted any of that stuff.
I think it's great that they did Johnny Mnemonic, because fine, ruin that short story for me. That's okay. If that saves the other material by proving what a bad idea it is, then I'm cool with that.
Yeah. Anyway. So in thinking about it, I was just like, geez, like, they made Tristram Shandy into a film, for goodness sake. Like, what's safe anymore? And, you know, before we used to be kind of protected because of either, like, technology or length.
Right.
But, you know, Lord of the Rings blew the barrier for length out of the water.
Yep.
And then, you know, CGI is, I don't know if it's like a false sense of security about the kind of degree of difficulty. I'm of two minds about CGI, because we've kind of moved past the effect for effect's sake. Some filmmakers are still doing it, but, you know, we're well into the point where, you know, people are going to bring technology to bear on a story to tell the story now.
Well, I remember reading an interview with Neil Gaiman where he was talking about Beowulf, the motion capture film that he wrote for Zemeckis, and he felt like he was, you know, going over the top with some of the special effects requirements in some of the scenes. And Zemeckis told him, look, there's absolutely nothing that you can write that I can't put on the screen for $1 million a minute, which means, you know, where films regularly have budgets of $120 million, that there is not a 2-hour film that you can make that's quote unquote too expensive.
Yeah, which just kind of makes me resigned to like the inevitability of seeing certain things on film, you know, and like the Halperin example is a great example where you're just like, oh, I wish they wouldn't, but they probably will.
And they'll, yeah. And all the things I loved about it won't be there because it's not about the special effects.
Yeah. So, you know, along the lines of Life of Pi, you've read Life of Pi, right?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. They're apparently going to make Life of Pi into a movie. And I'm just like, really? Okay. But along those lines, I chose Haroon and the Sea of Stories by Salman Rushdie.
Okay.
And that was his first book right after the fatwa. I think it's his only children's book. And he wrote it for his son. And it's, you know, the stories that a Pulitzer Prize winning author would tell his kids, kind of thing. It starts right there. And so it's this like whimsical kind of phantasmagorical. Yeah. But it's got this like underlying bed of like really, you know, wicked satire and intelligence. And it's one of those cases where, yeah, you could film it, but what you would lose isn't just like a plot line or a character or whatever. You'd kind of have to gut it. And so I'm like, ambitious filmmaker might take that on and think that they're really getting to it, but I just hope that they don't. So that's...
Do you think it could be done in the, like by a Terry Gilliam, or, you know, in that Baron von Munchausen kind of way?
Yeah, yeah, you know, and in thinking about this question, there was all those movies that are nice adjuncts to books.
Right.
Right, that are good complements. And of the books that I was thinking of, like, you could do, you know, you could do a kind of like hat tip piece to this. I don't know.
So again,
It would be tempting to make into a movie. I just hope that they don't.
Yeah.
Along the lines of what you were saying.
Sounds like you're right.
So let's move on. I want to talk about The Queen's Gambit. It's the story of a girl, Elizabeth Harmon, who's really good at chess. She's talented. She's determined. She's kind of obsessed. She also happens to be 8. And so it's the story of a chess prodigy.
Is this fiction or nonfiction?
It's fiction. It's a novel.
Okay.
And the story follows her time from a Kentucky orphanage in the late 50s to the showdown that she has with kind of like a chess grandmaster in Moscow years later. And along the way, it is... it's kind of like the Disney Hall of Presidents attraction. It's like a whistle-stop tour of kind of 1960s America anxieties. So okay. You get, you know, so there's the through line of the young prodigy, but in the background, Tevis reveals these like snapshots of kind of, well, like there's the Red Scare, there's like commentary on race, there's commentary on feminism, and so you get you get the pace of like a really good thriller, and then mixed with this like John O'Hara sensibility about America, mid turn of the century kind of.
And when was this written?
1983.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's just a really neat find, and I think you personally and anyone that's listened to the show gets, I love discovering books like these that are just kind of like gem finds, and you know, might not be amazing, but I'm just like so happy to have stumbled over them. So I'll tell you just briefly how I found it.
Okay.
So Tevis wrote it in 83. He died in 84. The edition I bought was published in like 20 years later, like 2003-ish. And I literally bought this book because of the cover. So it's from Random House. And a Random House rep, like a long, long time ago, after the success of The English Patient, told me that they would ask Michael Indaji to like blurb everything that they published. It would be like, dude, can you read this? And maybe, and he's just like, listen, no, like, and he just flat out refused. And then it got to the point where it was just like, I'm never endorsing anything for you guys.
Right.
Right. Cause they were just like shoveling stuff at him.
We've got a cookbook. Could you maybe say a little something?
So when I came across, Gambit on the shelf, looked at the cover, and there on the front cover is a blurb from Mundaci.
Awesome.
And so I was just like, holy, okay. So
what is the book that pried the words of praise from the reclusive Mundaci?
Yeah, and like so that got my attention, and then the blurb was just like, I really love this book, I reread it every couple of years, and so I was just like, oh, okay, so you know, not that I'm one to go in for kind of like marketing copy, but because of that backstory from the Random House rep, I was just like, okay, I should buy this, right? Like that's the best endorsement,
yep,
non-endorsement ever. So I was like, bring it on. And then I didn't know anything about Tevis either. But get this. So the guy wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth in 1963.
Okay.
And then he wrote The Hustler. The Hustler was his first novel in 1959. And then he wrote the sequel, The Color of Money.
So, given that kind of background, because those have all been turned into films, obviously.
Yeah, he's got like he wrote six novels, three of which are Hollywood productions of like fairly well renowned, right? So it's kind of funny that we're talking about, film adaptations these past two episodes.
Is there something about this book that prevents it? Because it sounds like, a Searching for Bobby Fischer meets Forrest Gump kind of movie, right? Like, it sounds like a great movie. Do you think there's something about it that...
I think it would be a good movie, actually.
Hmm.
And like they made Butterfield 8 into a movie, so
Everything's Butterfield.
he wrote a science fiction novel as well. I don't know. Anyway, so there's nothing preventing this from being a good movie other than the fact that it would just take some finessing to make the chess part really interesting.
But that's been done
Yeah.
before, so it's not impossible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't know when the last time you saw The Hustler. Have you seen The Hustler?
Yeah, but ages ago, ages ago.
It was made before you were born, so I was just
So.
checking. But it's like amazing. Like I love that movie. We would watch that movie over and over again in university. And everyone kind of remembers it primarily because of the pool sequences, because they're just wicked and whatever. But if you like a careful viewing of that movie, really the heart of that story is his relationship, Eddie Felsen's relationship with his like girlfriend, like Sarah or whatever her name is. And in 1959, like they hook up, they're not married, and then he has like this whole bout of depression when his thumbs get broken, and she's the one that comes and saves him and stuff like that. And the Queen's Gambit is kind of the same way that way. It's about chess. Like there's long sections where when she's like in a chess tournament and you follow her game to game, move to move. But it's really interesting because of her relationships with, like her relationships are like balanced and warped and sabotaged really by her obsession and by this thing that she's really good at, right? So she's orphaned, she is an alcoholic, and she's also a drug addict in some ways, right?
She's 8.
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay. It starts when she's 8, and then it goes on.
Yeah. Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
Okay.
So, well, so part of like in the orphanage, they've got so many of these kids that they essentially give them downers to keep them all. And so from the age of 8, she's given like tranquilizers twice a day.
Right.
And so that enters into the story early on, right? And it's just
Okay.
like, yeah, okay. And the look at parenting and marriage and home life and just kind of society in the 50s, that kind of like volume, that haze of opiates and prescription drugs that
A
was
pill for any
happening in the
problem, yeah.
suburbs, right?
Awesome.
Yeah, so what, yeah.
I'm completely sold.
Well, I don't
No,
like.
I mean, this sounds like a book that I'm going to enjoy just based on my own preferences in books. I love sports stories, and I absolutely consider, chess to be a sport. I feel like it's the kind of thing that you can write about and position in such a way of conflict and drama and achievement. And I also really, really enjoy stories about prodigies, both fiction and nonfiction. So just based on your description so far, it absolutely sounds like something that pushes my buttons.
Well, what kind of caught me about it was you don't normally see a story about obsession through a female lens. And that's kind of where the hook really dug in. Like one of the reviewers on Amazon calls it, and there's like tons of reviews on Amazon, which is nice. But one of the reviewers calls it Rocky for smart people. And I'm just like, yeah, that's apt. That's totally on the nose.
Well,
So the other kind of common thread through all the reviews that I was looking at just before we recorded was It's one of those books that everyone remembers reading like 25 years later.
Right.
They're like, oh yeah, I read that, and you know, I remember exactly how it ended, or you know, and it's just like, it's rare because I've been churning through Lee Child books. I'm like on Lee Child 13 now, right? Reading the Reacher books, and they're all starting to blend together. And this is one of those books that yeah, it's like so memorable, and it's a great literature. I'm not sure, but it's like definitely kind of a work of skill, and it's really gripping, and so it really puts its claws into you. Anyway. So that's my, that's my endorsement. I recommend people track it down. I hope it's still in print. I know that I was trying to find my copy of it to read it this week, and I couldn't find it, so I went and looked to see if it was at the library in Toronto, and they don't have it at the library, which is
shameful,
kind of shocking and odd. So I just hope that it's around, because I bought it a couple years ago and just got around to reading it. So, so hopefully you can track it down.
All right. I'm going to take a look for it. You're going to kill the show though, because I'm going to spend all my time reading your recommendations and not reading new books.
Yeah. Like that ever happens. Anyway, let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up. We're going to end it there. Please check out our blog at enthusiasticast.com, where you can leave comments on the post for this episode. You'll also find some other writing that we do about books and culture in general. You can also follow us on Twitter. Mark is M-MDASH. I'm Ninja Wins, and the show is Enthusiasticast. Finally, if you want to reach out to us more directly, you can send an email to hello@enthusiasticast.com. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening. Wait a minute. Are you saying Rocky's not for smart people?